circumstances expressed in, various ways. So in that way, it sort of resonates with ourselves and everyone in a more sort of immediate way, rather than sort of dry theory. Well, it's how the theory is sort of brought to life. Maybe that's not quite the right way of putting it. I think I'll maybe chip in a bit later on with when we move on to your different sort of ways of how that alienation expresses itself. I'll park it for there, but yeah, I'll certainly chip in later. Thanks very much.
Okay, Howard, next.
Okay, yeah, sure. I'm booked to give a talk next Friday myself, actually, and it's what you've said, Danny, eerily ties in with a good deal of that. It's a talk on art and entertainment in human society. Mm. And it may not be immediately obvious how it ties in, but having sort of thought about it and written a few things down, it does actually, because my talk is definitely not going to be at just what I would call as higher philosophical level. However, I am planning to talk about the way in which certain aspects of capitalism, certain behaviours amongst people, amongst workers in capitalism, are effectively a form of alienation. The way in which you... I'm not going to talk about this specifically next week, but an example that comes to mind is how these sort of baying crowds at football matches go absolutely mad when their team score a goal. Now, it may not be immediately obvious that's to do with the alienation, but and there's a certain sort of... The positive of that is there's a community there at least. People have a sort of communal connection. But it's a sort of substitute, really, for sort of self-creation, for creating things that they themselves are good at. On the whole, the system in capitalism doesn't allow that. Most of their waking life is spent at work, is spent in employment. These football matches are a kind of substitute somehow for expressing that. But, expressing that at a very sort of poor level. And the same applies to these sort of concerts, Taylor Swift concerts, where thousands of these poor girls, are absolutely beside themselves because this woman who they would like to be, presumably, or who would like to express their own talents, is sort of there in front of them. So, I found the talk very interesting, for a number of reasons, but one of them was that it sort of very much ties in with the way in which something absolutely fundamental to the human species, that is, the need to express themselves sort of creatively and the need to sort of, seek entertainment, if you like, is stymied by the way in which capitalism works and creates, as I see it, I wasn't going to use the word in next week's talk, but I might well now, form of alienation. Right, that's it then for the moment.
Can I make a quick comment?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because I don't know where to find the yellow hand. That topic that you just brought up, Howard, is one very close to my heart, because actually, at least as far as the music part of art and entertainment is concerned, I wrote a book that came out only 3 weeks ago that you can find on Amazon. This is not a plug, but I had no intention of bringing it up otherwise. But it's called The Complete History of Rock, 1950 to 2025, and it's the only complete history of rock. But it basically only covers the more innovative side of rock. I thought I'd write a history that would leave out the pop side as much as possible. Because, yes, it isn't even just the big people like Taylor Swift. I mean, so much as a musician myself, I mean, it's amazing how often, I mean, almost overwhelmingly, bands are motivated by issues about getting fans or creating music that they think will appeal, when art is not about what appeals, really. I mean, it's supposed to be something very, something fresh and novel, and, you know, and the hyping that goes on with all kinds of totally rubbishy pop bands on the covers of NME or something. I mean, it's legendary. And so, yeah, it's something you do get a sense if you're listening to more interesting music, whether it's rock or jazz or classical or just experimental music in general. You really do get a sense of how of what kind of elevator music most of it is, you know, and how much it's there to fill a kind of a void that can only come from this social setting in which we live and in which we feel so separated. Yes, and I suppose from which we then enjoy that feeling of being together, although I'm not sure we can extract it purely to alienation, because we are social beings after all, who would probably enjoy, you know, standing together and enjoying music together and dancing and so on. But yeah, no, I just wanted to echo that. That good luck. It sounds like a great talk, and good luck with that.
Okay, thanks. Mike's already spoken, so I'll take Dougie next.
Yeah, it's interesting about alienation. I mean, how we relate to employment and things like that. I mean, I worked with somebody, and he always talked about going for a sweet pea and things. His bodily functions were one of the highlights of his day, right? You know, when he was working there, and the job wasn't that bad, right, that he did. You know, he worked in a lab situation, but he was pretty well alienated. And I talked to some people about football, right? My dad used to take me to all the Rangers games when I was young. And what they said was, you know, they hated their job, but they could really lash out at the football game or whatever, you know. And it was a way of them expressing themselves, supporting Rangers or Celtic or whatever. And it was part of the alienation, really, you know. So I don't know. But anyway, I mean, I suffer from schizophrenia, and I find it helpful to talk to other people that have the same condition and get empathy and things. And a lot of that comes about from the environment, really, you know, because some of it's genetic and some of it's environmental, really, you know. And everybody ends up on drugs, really, you know. But, I mean, if you're lucky, you can be stable on drugs. But, you know, talking to other people and getting support from other people with the same condition is often better than talking to a psychiatrist, or, you know. So, anyway.
Okay, thanks. Mike, next.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I'll just while I remember it, I'll keep it quick, because I don't want to sort of take up the discussion in sort of different direction. But yeah, Howard, I'd recommend Peter Watkins's 1967 film Privilege, if you haven't seen it, in relation to your talk. And that's about how a manufactured pop star is sort of manipulated by the state to sort of control the masses. So it sort of chimes in with the with what you were saying about music as a form of social control. I mean, it's sort of set in the sort of near future. It's a sort of dystopia, as it were. But yeah, worth checking out. But yeah, I'll maybe sort of park this for next week's talk. But I think with people who are sort of devotees of music or football, I think maybe being a bit unfair to them in terms of alienation, because that's often used, or you know, following a band or following a football team is used as a sort of an antidote to sort of alienation. In the, you know, as you said, it involves sort of getting together with like-minded people for a shared experience, and yeah, that might be as a reaction to, you know, the alienating working week and the frustrations of that, and you know, people get a bit of a relief, when there's a concert or something, but or a match. And of course, you know, both of those realms are very, very commercialized, more so than in the past, especially, you know, the bigger acts like, you know, Taylor Swift. But the it's obviously sort of fueled by, you know, commercialism for it, but I don't think that takes away necessarily from the emotional reassurance that people get from that kind of shared experience. Because it'd be completely different if you were standing in the room listening to the same music or standing alone watching the same football match, because you don't get the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is as much of the experience as the match or the music itself. So I think I'm not sure if that's the best example of how alienation expresses itself, because, as I say, it's a sort of a remedy, if you like, for alienation. And that's, of course, that's not to say, you know, there'll be football matches and concerts in a socialist society, I hope. So that's not to say that, you know, those activities are only there as a response to alienation. But yeah, I think it's I'd say it's a remedy maybe rather than an example of alienation. Yeah, cheers.
Okay, thanks, Howard again.
Just to say, Mike, I'm actually a football fan myself, but something that occurs to me is that some time ago, a former work colleague of mine used to proffer an explanation about what going to the stadium on Saturday to support your football team was. He used to say, wasn't a socialist as far as I know, but he used to see it as a substitute for something that's now more or less gone out of fashion, which is going to church. He would say that his argument was that he'd offered people the same kind of oblivion past generations found in worshipping a god or a divinity. Instead, they had the sort of star footballer or their football team as a replacement for this. And that this stood in as a kind of replacement for the lack of opportunity to express their own talents freely in their daily lives. Wouldn't want to take it much further, but that was his sort of take on it anyway. Other thing I want to say is that, Danny, I've just looked you up on Amazon. At the risk of embarrassing you, the book looks absolutely fantastic, and I can get it by Monday as well. I can get it delivered by Monday, it refers to you, and you no doubt confirm this, as a psychologist who is a music obsessive. Is that correct?
Right, that's correct. Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes. And by the way, any times that I made any reference to musicians who were like maybe Robert Wyatt, or I can't remember who, a bunch of musicians who identified with the Communist Party or whatever, I would always make it quite clear as a socialist what those parties actually did stand for. So I found ways to actually even clarify the use of words like socialism, communism, and so on, even in the book, even though it probably didn't turn up much. But I think half a dozen times I did do that. So, yeah, you probably, it's in a very minor way. You could call it a socialist book, but in a very, very minor way.
Maybe on that basis, we can review it in the standard.
Oh, no, please don't. Yes. But some of the things that have been said so far, though, do seem to imply that alienation could be reduced, right? Whether it's through the pleasures of being together, watching a football game or music or something. So I was curious to know what the thoughts were about that, because alienation would be presumably, you know, that feeling of being kind of, you know, feeling a bit of a stranger in a strange land, I guess, with many, many, many ramifications, which maybe in a bit if we run out of ideas, I can bring up earlier, I suppose. I'll let you know what my 13 were. But the implication is that we can, you know, we can sort of somehow reduce the effect of it even without changing the society that we live in, which, you know, introduces a bit of a paradox about what it is.
I've put my own hand up this time, so I'm going to allow myself to proceed just with a couple of comments on just what you were just saying there, Danny, about reducing ways to reduce alienation. I mean, I had just been in the middle of thinking about ways that alienation exists in the environment around me. I can see it every day. But just to talk about this, how you reduce alienation, you're probably familiar. I know we have in the north of England, there's lots of like beautiful countryside and lots of old you know, country estates and mansions and things like that, and some of them have been given over to for use by recovering addicts. They've been made into centres for, you know, recovering alcoholics, recovering addicts. And apparently the reasoning is they have a much better success rate than inner city centres. And the reason for that is, so the thinking goes, if you want people to get out of the rut of their addictive lifestyles, you have to take them out of their normal circumstances, their normal environment, and put them somewhere where, just for a change, life actually looks like it's worth living. You put them somewhere generally really attractive. Let them stay there for a few weeks. Let them get used to the idea that life isn't all shit, because they're suddenly surrounded by an absolutely beautiful landscape. And apparently, so I was told, when I used to be a support worker years ago, and I was told that the success rate for this is surprisingly high. It does have an effect on people. So that is one way of reducing alienation, is to change a person's environment. And that leads me on to what I was going to say in the first place, was the part of town I live in is the sort of, it's council estates, it's, you know, student flats. If it was the British Monopoly Board, it would be, my house would be the Old Kent Road. But right at the top of my, just at the top of my street, there's a beautiful canal. It's very lovely. Through the seasons, you get swans, ducks, migrating birds, kingfishers sometimes, the weeping willows along the banks. It can be really, really lovely. And in the sort of nice stretches of it, it really is just beautiful. My stretch through the council estates, it's got fridges dumped in it, old bikes and all sorts of junk that people have just tipped in it. It's only in my stretch. And what it seems to me is, this is where the poor people live. And people care least about the environment when they perceive that the environment cares least about them. The bins are never taken in. So the bins are always being tipped over by the kids. So there's rubbish down the back alleys all the time. You know, I feel sorry for the bin men clearing this up. But I do see it a lot, and people dropping litter in an environment, they don't want it to be ugly. They don't want their environment to be ugly, but they perceive that it is ugly, that it doesn't care about them because, you know, the world doesn't care about them. Why should they care about it? And to me, that aspect of alienation is very real, very tangible. It's outside my door every day when I go out into it. And I do wonder if this is partly why, you know, eco-activism, environmental activism, is perceived as being such a middle-class preoccupation. Because middle-class people, you know, I use the term in inverted commas, middle-class people don't feel that the world doesn't care about them. They do feel some level of engagement in it and a level of responsibility for it. They are proactive on environmental issues in a way that a lot of the people who live in my area just don't. They don't engage. They'll just chuck litter in the street, even if there's a bin nearby. They just don't care, because that's the level that they've got to. It's almost like they live on a different planet from other people who do put their stuff in bins and, you know, don't. You know, do recycle and all the sort of things that you're supposed to do. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. Is there a sort of level of alienation involved in the sort of stratification of environmental activism as well? Thank you. I'm having spoken, I've just noticed that Mike's got his hand up, so over to Mike again.
Yeah, cheers, seeing as no one else got their hands up. Well, unless you wanted to respond to what Paddy just said, Danny, or...
No, I think you're right. And it made me think a lot. Paddy's right, I think. And I see that every day myself, because I live in a tall building in Chicago, where I work on. I'm the chair of the Sustainability Commission, so I help with all those kind of green efforts that we can do in our building. And quite a lot of people are involved in it, actually, and participate in it. But there are also a fair amount, I'd say a good third to maybe 40% of people who are just extremely wasteful, you know, and literally don't care at all. And so there's something about, yeah, the kind of culture, the kind of highly individualistic culture that capitalism produces that does seem to be very much, an effect of alienation in many ways. After all, the governments don't seem to care. Now, maybe the government, you know, if you're living in the UK, maybe it appears to care more. I don't know. I mean, certainly in the States, when you look at what we're dealing with now, I mean, this total, you know, the violence of it and the total disregard for the environment, you know, the denial of climate change, the dysregulating of all the laws that we've had, all the environmental laws. I mean, it's really quite horrifying. So yeah, we have to live with that degree of total disregard, and people, I guess, on an emotional level, have to deal with it too. So in some ways, you could argue that the people who are contributing are trying to heal that on some level, right? They're trying to heal something in themselves when they do recycle or participate, because participating in all kinds of little eco things like that isn't really going to make a huge difference anyway. When you look at the amount of damage being done to the planet from entire governments and corporations and, you know, practices, we're really just a drop in the ocean. So if many of us are doing it, probably not even deluding ourselves that we're making a big difference. It just seems like the right thing to do. So it could be a kind of response to wanting a more humane culture on some level. And so it's a response to that. And I suppose that would be why maybe it is somewhat more stratified among the eco warriors. If they're not living hand to mouth quite as much, maybe as others. I mean, they're clearly workers, but maybe they had just those extra resources that allow them to be more educated or have more time to read or whatever. Yes.
Okay, thanks. So, Mike, do you want to come in?
Cheers. Yeah. Well, it was sort of the first part of what you said, Paddy, that I wanted to come back on. You mentioned those retreats for people with problematic substance use, and there's quite a few of those sort of semi-rural or sort of remote rehabs. There's a few near me, and they work fine for people who sort of chime in with that way of thinking, and that way of thinking is often religious, and the AA method of overcoming problematic substance misuse is to put your faith in a higher power, which is usually God. So, that method is often sort of disparagingly referred to as, you know, you swap one addiction for another, you know, an addiction to a substance to an addiction to a belief in a higher power. They're not quite equivalent, and obviously that's a bit flippant to say that, but I suppose my sort of maybe more less flippant point was about problematic substance use. So I'm not talking here about, you know, a couple of pints or getting wasted every now and again, or, you know, a couple of joints of an evening, or even the occasional sort of snort of cocaine. But when sort of substance use becomes sort of problematic, especially opiate heroin use, that sort of alienation at some of its worst manifestations, because in those instances, you know, someone's substance use is used to blot out other kinds of alienation through lack of money, lack of a house, lack of supportive social networks, lack of opportunity, all the sort of hallmarks of capitalism that, you know, affect some people disproportionately even worse than it affects others, those pushed towards homelessness especially, who would then turn to problematic substance use, not just to blot out alienation. So, in that sense, you're swapping you're treating symptoms of alienation with even worse, or with something which makes your alienation even worse. So in that sense, it's the opposite, if you like, of people who enjoy football matches or music, in that. But of course, you know, problematic substance use, it not only blots out alienation, it also gives your life a structure in terms of all your routines would be subordinated to drug seeking behavior. But also in that sense, it alienates you from yourself, in that, you know, you're blotting things out to blot out past trauma. So, yeah, I suppose, again, to sort of loop it back to the music and football analogy, it's sort of the problematic substance use is the opposite of that, in that both are ways of dealing with our everyday alienation through work or, you know, problematic relationships. But one way, sort of, as I say, is a partial remedy or sticking plaster, whereas the other way, problematic substance use, is the more sort of negative and self-destructive way that people don't cope with alienation. Cheers. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Dougie's got his hand up.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about substances, but sometimes alcohol, it just releases people's inhibitions or whatever and stuff like that. So that's one of the reasons people take it. I take your point about football matches and concerts and things. You know, I was trying to say that people who are alienated at work, they'll live for the Saturday game or they'll live for the concert or whatever, you know, because that's something that they enjoy, and it's the work they don't enjoy. You know, they maybe see their bodily functions at work, using the toilet, is a way of being human or whatever, which is a bit sad, really, you know. And there was a guy I worked with who was like that, really, you know. And anyway, yeah. I mean, I just think, I had a friend who was an alcoholic, but he was an atheist, you know. He wouldn't go with AA, but he did go in to get dried out a few times or whatever. But he was in central Manchester. He wasn't anywhere in the countryside when he did that. So, I don't know. Okay, that's all I want to say, Ryan.
There is very little more alienating, I think, than or a more potent example of it, as you were suggesting, Mike, of a heroin addict, because the ones I've worked with, many of them are unemployed, and also homeless, and many of them are literally, I mean, comparing their lives, even to the quote that Marx provided with regards to, you know, us not, you know, not being able to live the creative life where we can do all these different things. And I guess it was another quote, right, about us spending some time fishing and writing poetry and all the rest of it. But these people are literally, they couldn't possibly hold down even a job because of their addiction, because they're literally spending like 6 hours of the day just trying to get this, you know, pathetic amount of heroin so they can then literally blot out, you know, another maybe 4 hours of the day in a state of complete bliss, as they describe it. I mean, they're just in this sort of semi-sleeping state where they can literally just feel some pleasure and kind of completely blot out, you know, the complete misery of the other 18 or whatever hours are left of the day to, you know, to live in the most squalid conditions in a tent under a bridge or something. So clearly, yeah, there is a for sure relationship, I would say, between alienation and addiction.
Howard?
Sorry again. I won't. Nobody else has got their hand up, so might as well say what's in my mind. First of all, two things. Yeah, it's a good point you made, Mike, and that was sort of endorsed by Danny there, that there is a big difference between the alienation associated with drug taking and so on and going to football matches. Yeah, okay. Definitely, yeah. Wouldn't want to sort of, you know, press the sort of similarity too hard. The other thing I wanted to say, Danny, is that I've noticed that your book is 820 pages long. Yes. How long did it take you to write it? Please tell us.
Oh, well, it took a lot. I mean, it really didn't take all that long. I'd written the history. I started writing the history about 15 years ago, up until 1967. And I had 150 pages at that point, but it was so overwhelming, the amount of releases that were coming out in 1967, that I just got overwhelmed and stopped. And then it was about a year ago, literally, I mean, almost to the day, somewhere in January last year, that I worked on the rest of it. And I put in sometimes 6 to 8 hour days, which is unhealthy, really, because most writers wouldn't write more than maybe 2 to 4 hours a day. But there were days that, and also it wasn't even just writing. I had to listen to thousands of albums and make sort of hair pulling decisions about what was better than something else. Entirely subjective, although I tried my best to argue it in the book. So, yeah, I mean, basically it took a year to write that remaining, whatever it was, 700 pages or so. So, yeah, it was almost an everyday thing, almost, and almost the whole day was spent writing it.
Right, thank you. And it also says that if I order it today, I'll get it by Monday. So,
oh wow. You know, I was quite amazed how quickly these things are printed up, like through Amazon, because someone wrote to me. You see, it's going to appear. There's an ad for it in 8 rock magazines. There's a full page ad for it, and the first one appeared in a magazine. I think it's a British metal magazine. I think called Decibel. I think, and immediately people started buying it. And one guy contacted me to say that I'd made a mistake with one of the ambient artists who I'd called a UK jazz musician when actually he was from the States. And I'm sure that was just a typo that I missed. So I was able to actually make the change. I thanked him, of course, made the change, uploaded the manuscript. And in 15 minutes, Amazon is now going to be selling a copy without at least that mistake. But it did make me wonder, you know, whether I was going to get 500 emails correcting me in other places. But anyway, I'll be happy to make those corrections. Would it be helpful for me to go now over my 13 types of alienation?
I think it probably would, actually.
Okay,
yes.
Maybe that would be a good use of our time. Okay, so here's what I listed. So the first one, I divided it up into different types of alienation. So the first place is workplace related. So one of them would be something like Bullshit Jobs is, of course, the title, of course, as many of you may know, is reviewed in The Standard, a book by the anthropologist David Graeber, who died a few years ago, who actually corresponded with briefly, and who had actually an identical sense of what he would have called anarchism, as we call socialism. And in his book, Bullshit Jobs, that book is – so basically, bullshit jobs are a great example of the kind of meaninglessness that workers can feel when, you know, feeling that their jobs contribute nothing of real value to society, like shuffling papers, pointless meetings, managing unnecessary bureaucracy. They may attribute it to a bad career choice. But perhaps, you know, we as socialists would understand such meaninglessness as the result of a system that prioritizes profit and managerial control, you know, over genuine human needs. So that could be one aspect of alienation that's workplace related. The other one would be career burnout, you know, experiencing just exhaustion, cynicism, just sort of a reduced efficacy, I suppose, which very often is treated as a mental health issue, actually, in the workplace. But we might see that as the direct results of a kind of a forced, kind of externally controlled labor that, as Marx was saying, mortifies, to use that quote, it's a great quote, actually, I have to remember that, mortifies the body and mind, you know, basically ruins the mind just for the sake of accumulating capital. And that's all that that's about. And then, of course, there's this whole phenomenon also work-related of what's called the Sunday scaries or Monday blues, that sort of dread and anxiety that people can feel on a Sunday evening about the return to work. And again, that's interpreted purely as a psychological state. In fact, it's amazing how often I have encountered that being in the mental health field myself. You know, how many times things are attributed to being purely individually psychological when it's obvious how they are in response to their environment. But clearly, that these kinds of feelings reveal that the person is sort of, you know, their life, the fundamental life activity, which should be our work, is experienced as a sort of denial, in a way, a kind of a denial of oneself. You know, so we have to deny ourselves, and that is exactly what Marx was describing there. And then, of course, the whole quiet quitting, which is basically the act of doing the bare minimum required to keep one's job, right? Again, we would be accused, no doubt, of being lazy, but probably it's not a good idea to necessarily do the minimum. I mean, even in capitalism, it's probably better for us to feel, you know, to feel as much pride and do our job as best as we can. But we have a coping mechanism, you know, which may be to sometimes psychologically withdraw from the process that we know is not actually our own, you know, and a process that may not give us any real fulfillment. So that would be alienation from workplace, in the workplace rather. Then there's alienation from species being, which is one of those that Marx mentioned, one of the four. One of them that I could think of would be something like compulsive consumerism. So we're seeking personal identity and a kind of a fulfillment through buying things and displaying commodities. You know, people go shopping. Yes, we need things. Obviously, we shop because there are things we really need and we require. We need to buy back some of the wealth that we produced to survive. But it's also, you know, a kind of a shopping as therapy thing happens as well with people who need certain kinds of expensive clothes, Nike shoes or whatever. And again, I think it's an attempt to resolve the emptiness that's created by our alienated labor, you know. And of course, the system's proposed solution, I suppose, is consumption. That's kind of what the system urges us to do. And also there's a search also related to species being, meaning how we fly from ourselves. There's a constant search for a kind of authenticity. So in other words, a feeling of not knowing who you really are, you know, who are you fundamentally? Who are you? And so this underpins, I think, a lot of the search that people make for some kind of identity. And people are so caught up in all kinds of identity, and for self-help, or for like, you know, like finding your passion in something, you know, maybe even that, you know, on some level, again, stemming from the worker being kind of denied the chance to express their species essence, their creative and conscious labor in their daily life. And then there's also a kind of escapism, the idea that escapism as freedom, in other words, equating freedom and happiness with the complete avoidance of work and productive activity. You know, so we're going to binge watch TV shows, maybe. So many teenagers I know, male in particular, are just excessively gaming, you know, spending like 6 hours a day, unless their parents are wise enough to prevent it, playing games on all the time. You know, a sense of life being... I mean, you would see that, you know, among young adults. It's true, teenagers aren't working, that's true. But, you know, young adults in their 20s who are working, work seems coerced and kind of painful maybe on some level. And so the only available freedom that people can come up with is a passive one, a kind of passive consumption and a kind of inaction, you know, because you're really not doing anything when you're playing a video game. And that was just an example. And then another one I thought of was the gig economy itself. And, you know, it's a state of existence where in which material provision, getting what you need, and our wellness, our psychological wellness, are negatively affected because we can't get work regularly, right? These people aren't working all the time, or they're working, you know, or in some cases working extremely long periods of time to make the same money that they could earn in a normal job. And they can't secure the income that they could maybe make in a more normal job. So all these people who are freelancers, gig workers, you know, they're constantly cycling through kind of short and very stressful tasks, isolated tasks. And again, they believe that they're their own boss, you know, that that's a great thing to be their own boss. But really, all they've done, in a sense, is taken on the risk of the capitalist while remaining fundamentally alienated from the means and the security of their own livelihood. So that would be ways in which we may express alienation from our species being, from who we're supposed to naturally be as productive, creative human beings. Then there is also, I thought of, alienation from others. And my list actually goes on a bit. Yeah, it goes to 13. Alienation from others, or what we could call social alienation. So one of them I thought of might be a kind of a, it's online stuff, online, what's called hyper-individualism and isolation. In other words, you're connected to people, allegedly you're connected to people digitally, but you're really feeling profoundly lonely or seeing people as rivals on the internet, you know, on dating apps or maybe in the job market or on social media. Because capitalism does, after all, pit worker against worker for jobs, right? For scarce jobs, for resources. And so it destroys the natural, the sort of genuine community solidarity that we could enjoy otherwise if we didn't have that pitting of human against human, as Marx would say. Of course, it's also the worker against the capitalist too, of course, who are have diametrically opposed interests, as the SPGB's Declaration of Principles states. And then I was thinking that there's a certain commodification of social skills. And by that, I mean that the need to perform emotional labor, like I was mentioning in that article that I wrote in The Standard, the fake smiles that you see in a shop, the kind of programmed empathy we're supposed to put on at times, all done for a wage in the service economy. And so a very genuine quality, after all, you know, our kindness, our compassion, all those human qualities are kind of turned into a kind of required marketable commodity. So that's an expression of alienation, you know, this sort of fakeness that we have to put on. And then there's also the envy or the resentment of rich people and successful people. I think that's also a kind of an alienation as well, you know. And we attribute the vast disparity in wealth to luck. At least that's what the ideology is telling us. You're not lucky. Maybe you're not clever enough. You know, there's a moral failure because you're not doing as well as this person living on the mansion up the hill. Rather than attributing those differences to the structural mechanism of exploitation, which actually, you know, extracts wealth from the collective work of many people. So we end up experiencing all these negative things that are totally the result of the system that we live under. And then, touching on what Paddy was saying, there's alienation from nature as well. And that relates, I think, to, to the view that's imparted by the capitalist system, by commodity production, because we really do live. I love that term that the situationist came up with, a dictatorship of commodities. We do live in a dictatorship of commodities, and it's basically a kind of a relentless exploitation of the natural world, not just to meet needs, but nature is just viewed as a resource to be exploited for profit. That's how not just human beings are viewed, but how nature as a whole, our only home, the only home we're ever probably going to have, is viewed. And so, you know, when ecologists use words like raping, I think that's appropriate. You know, so yeah, so I think that is sort of pushed on us, that alienation from nature, which of course, as Paddy was saying, we resist, or many people resist, you know, because they see it for what it is and they don't want to be reduced to that, and they want to protect nature in some way or other, you know, live in harmony with it. But also connected, I think, with environmental issues is the apathy that people, which Paddy touched upon as well, the apathy people feel towards the environment and the sense of powerlessness that we feel seeing it being destroyed. I think we feel very overwhelmed and kind of detached. I can't tell you how, I mean, just nauseated people are in the United States. And of course, it's not just what we're doing to the environment and how we're rolling back all the environmental laws, but even, you know, of course, we're also experiencing all these other things, like these huge black cars that come out of nowhere and drag people out of their homes. It's just, I mean, I feel like crying almost. I mean, they really, people now in the States are living in a sense of complete, you know, feeling overwhelmed, detached, and sort of almost not knowing how to act against what they're experiencing in a way. But certainly in an environmental sense, we don't know what to do about climate change or ecological collapse. And so, you know, the powerlessness stems from the knowledge that that the forces that are driving environmental destruction, which are really the endless pursuit of capital accumulation, are massive, right? Massive forces, impersonal forces, beyond any individual control, which is why we need mass action, you know, now, right? We need to do something as workers, as a society. So that would be my 13th one. So those basically are my 13 types of alienation that the solution, of course, is, you know, the only real solution, of course, is to abolish that alienation by bringing the means of production into the hands of the community, so that we feel as though our creative, productive lives are benefiting both ourselves and others. And of course, we have to live in the alienating world that we have now anyway. So that's where this paradox comes in, which is, I think we all believe that we do owe it to ourselves to live as authentically as we can anyway today. Even while acknowledging that the system that we live under has a lot to do with those feelings and are not our personal failings. You know, we need to know that. But still, but that doesn't mean, even though we have existential choices now, that this isn't an ongoing thing that we're going to be suffering with while we live in capitalism. So there you go. That was my thoughts on those 13. Anyway, any further comments or thoughts?
Mike again.
Thanks for that. I think your list sort of pretty much covers everything from different angles. I think it's especially important to draw attention to sort of online alienation, because of course that's much newer than all the other varieties, and you know, the consequences of that are still being sort of, they're still emerging, whereas, you know, the consequences of other kinds of alienation we sort of got used to in a way. I think it's important to draw attention to that aspect. I don't know if I've sort of maybe come up with another one related to workplace alienation. I'm not quite sure how to describe it with a 4 or 5 word title. But what I'm thinking of, and I'm a bit rusty on some of these aspects of Marxist philosophy, but isn't there something about the connection between alienation and fetishism, in that they're sort of two sides of the same coin? And I think I was thinking in relation to workplaces, in the way that rules and procedures and hierarchies are fetishized. You know, we believe, oh, that's just the way it is, and we you know, internalize them and you know, learn not to question them beyond a certain point. And of course, if we do question them beyond that certain point vocally during a works meeting, you know, if I was to, you know, chime in with, you know, oh, you know, we wouldn't have these issues in a socialist society, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'll be probably having an appointment with HR at some point soon. So, I suppose my point was that because we fetishize rules, procedures, policies, hierarchies, in a workplace because of the structure of those workplaces, that alienates us from some aspect of ourselves, in particular our ability to question, to view other people as equal, to realise that procedures aren't sort of set in stone or shouldn't be set in stone in a, you know, democratically organised society. So I think, yeah, there's a kind of workplace alienation in our relationship with those sort of non-physical structures. Yeah, cheers.
Okay. Richard, next.
Hi. It's really, really interesting. Thanks very much for this, because I haven't really thought about alienation for years and years. So I don't really have a sort of like kind of coherent kind of view about it. But I kept making lots of little notes. So I've just got kind of some ideas that are kind of whizzing through my head. As I remember Marx's take on alienation, it wasn't particularly psychological in the way that he's presenting it. I mean, clearly it can be seen as having psychological kind of consequences. And it's just occurring to me there that, you know, we can experience alienation as a feature of our world without actually necessarily being conscious of it as alienation. So we get lots of illnesses. We have sort of lots of negative responses to our world, but we don't really kind of understand it in terms of alienation. If I'm writing this, I'm pretty sure that the whole concept of alienation came into Western society around about the late Middle Ages, with the concept of alienation from God, as so much else did. You know, it's like the laws of science were taken over from the laws of God, and alienation was taken over from the alienation from God, and rights and duties were taken over from the idea of rights and duties towards God in the Middle Ages. So I think this is a whole kind of process that is actually been going on. And it occurs to me, of course, the whole notion of God is itself already an alienation from our social identity as human beings. We're projecting parts of ourselves out into the outside ourselves and then sort of bowing down and worshipping it, as Marx actually pointed out. But what really kind of really interests me was social alienation. We talked about sort of concert going and enjoying sports and things. But if you go back to look at genuinely coherent societies without private property, the one thing that you actually notice about all of them is that this division between creator and performer disappears. So that, like, for example, among hunter-gatherers, you will get the whole community will sing. You won't get sort of groups of people who will sit back as an audience and listen to their favorite singers. Everyone will sing. And with sports, for example, as well. Mike was saying he hoped we would still have football in socialism. I hope we don't, actually, or at least not football, but the competitive nature of football. Because when sports were introduced, have been introduced into hunter-gatherer groups, they have sometimes taken to the sports in a great way. But one thing that they do differently is that they will always refuse to keep the score. And they actually play the sports as participants, for the pleasure of playing the sports, not for kind of trying to win or lose, as we often find in sort of, well, as almost universally find in sports today. In terms of music, oh God, I am sick to death of the pap that gets produced, and it's becoming more and more and more prominent with sort of the software now that I mentioned this in a recent article, the software that companies now have, whereby they can identify exactly, you know, sort of what hooks attract people to buy their music, you know, what licks they need to introduce in order to attract the maximum number of buyers, and so on and so forth, so that they can actually predict. And then they have their in-house songwriters, so that they enter into contracts with performers, but they have their in-house songwriters who will write songs that will have all the required features to maximize sales, which then their performers are required to reproduce. And it's just got to incredible sort of levels. And now you get sort of radio, sort of is the medium through which music is often promoted to people, and you have these fixed slots of you know, sort of everything has to fit into the formula then, or to the time slot that radios will demand. As for work, my real experience of alienation work was that I was working for local government. And my job was in introducing certain government policies, and I had to read all this kind of policy stuff. And it was all presented as being to the advantage of the consumer, whereas it was absolutely clear. Basically, it was a money-saving exercise that I was being prepared to introduce, and it was actually going to make people's lives better. And I was required to say the right things, even though I didn't actually believe it. And even to the point where I kind of half started to believe it, because it became so second nature to me to sort of deal with this kind of information. And that was something that really kind of upset me. And I actually discovered, I suddenly realized that between the hours of 9 to 5, I was believing something. And after work, between the hours of 5 and 9 the next morning, I believed something completely different, which was hugely alienating to my experience. I felt really split in two about that. The whole thing about nature, alienation from nature. Paddy was talking about sort of 12-step groups and things. There's a lot of evidence also that if you build a hospital in natural surroundings, people do actually tend to recover more quickly than those sort of in city centres as well. But there seems to be an awful lot of research done on that now. And in fact, in America, you often actually, I'm told that there is a move to build hospitals sort of outside city centres now in more kind of natural surroundings. This thing about authenticity I thought was really interesting, because I was having a conversation about this with somebody a little while ago. I think although we can sort of identify paradigms where people are clearly being inauthentic because they're being manipulative, it's very hard to identify sort of like what is authentic in yourself and what isn't. Because in a society like the one that we live in, we have to put up our protections. So are our protections authentic to us, or are they not? Are they sort of just hiding something else? I think that's something that really kind of really sort of struck me. And going back to sort of like going back to work, like hunter-gatherers, they make no distinction between work and leisure, absolutely no distinction at all. Their work is part of their leisure is part of their work. These two things, they enjoy themselves while they're working. It's just part of their life. It's seamless. It's a kind of totality. Whereas we're divided entirely between we have a work period because we are working for somebody else. We're not working for ourselves or for the group. And so there's a huge sort of kind of alienation that actually happens there. Anyway, I've got a load of other notes, but I'll stop there. Just some ideas that sort of came up.
Okay, thanks for that. Dougie, did you say something?
Yeah. I was watching something on Facebook and probably slags me off for doing that. But it was David Attenborough, right? And what he said was 94% of mammals are human beings. And he said the other 6% are the other animals. And 70% of them are chickens because of the way they're produced to be ate or whatever, you know. And I mean, human beings have been responsible for a lot of animals disappearing, right, over the years. But I wanted to talk about America, because some of these politicians, you know, that are saying things, and RFK in America doing things against vaccines and things like that. Before the hepatitis B vaccine was given to babies in the first 24 hours, about 10,000 babies or 10,000 children ended up with liver cancer, and, you know, it was one of the biggest killers of children. But they're going back against that, right, you know, because the vaccine stopped that by about 90% or whatever. But Donald Trump's saying, oh, it's only sex that you get hepatitis B from, which is not the case. You can get it from small droplets of blood, or somebody who's got it and they don't know. Adults can have it and they don't know. And there's probably a few million adults in America that have got that. So I'm just going to say that politicians don't have any empathy. I mean, Trump, with his cuts to Medicare and things like that, I mean, the universities were saying, you know, there'll be 57,000 deaths more every year because of his cuts to Medicare or whatever in America. So these politicians have no empathy for the people that vote for them. They're just conning them into voting for them. I mean, Trump's been bragging about how he's sorted out the economy, which is the opposite of what's actually happened. So he just tells lies, really, you know. But, I mean, these politicians that are praising Donald Trump for doing things that he isn't doing, right? It's like 1984, really, you know. George Orwell, you know, what's going on in America with ICE and things like that. I mean, it's terrible, really, you know. What are these people like, you know, picking up a five-year-old kid, using them as bait to try and get the parents or whatever, and doing that kind of thing, and shooting a woman three times in the head when she's just trying to drive away, right, you know. And they just tell lies about it. Anyway, I'm going on about something. But, I mean, I think these politicians don't have any empathy for human beings, really, you know.
Right, okay, thank you. Well, it's 9 o'clock, and so we normally call it quits around about now. Danny, have you any last comments to round off the night? And
well, I've really enjoyed everyone's comments. There's almost too much to really comment about there, but there's just small things like the what you were saying about nature and therapy and all that. I mean, there was a new recent study, actually, that just being in more, even if you live in a city, being more immersed in the natural world, like even just a park, can quite a high percentage of cases improve people's depression as much as just psychotherapy. So obviously we have our, you know, several million year engagement with nature as our home that is very much a part of us, you know, part of our psyche on some level. I loved all of Richard's comments on so many different things, like sports and the idea of alienation, that God itself represents a type of alienation, and talking about the formulaic music on computers, which of course you have to remember it goes back a long ways, even before computers, because all those Brill building songwriters coming out of New York and so on, you know, people but anyway, yeah, I mean, it was all very much based even then as with an understanding of what kinds of sequences of notes and chord progressions, you know, could reach people and so on. And maybe computers have even liberated for some musicians the ability to do all kinds of interesting chopping of sounds and doing really interesting experimental things that they couldn't do before. But certainly your point is taken about the, you know, the pap that's on the crap that's on the radio and so on. I love the idea too about illnesses, how we often we can have illnesses that's in response to our stressful environment, but we wouldn't of course view any of it as alienation. I love that idea. And I loved also Mike's discussion of fetishism. Somewhere there is this concept of the fetishism of commodities, but I think when I brought it up last time I spoke here, which was only once before, I think Adam was saying it may not be Marx, it might have been Engels, or I don't know. I might be wrong about all that, but without doubt we are fetishizing rules and procedures and hierarchy, and that's a really excellent addition to my list of sources of alienation. I've been wanting actually to write a socialist book. I mean, there have been people who've, you know, we've all read certain books that have gone back over the decades, can't see the titles in the distance, but, you know, like, was it Free is Cheaper, or so, you know, we've had members, as you know, who've written all kinds of great books, and Paddy, of course, wrote and made that amazing movie and so on. So I thought I would quite like to try that out, I guess. So maybe I'll spend the next year doing that. But it would be very much, I think, rooted in the sort of experience of living in capitalism. So alienation probably would play a part in that, I'm sure, in many levels as I flesh it out. And I can generally do a better job writing than speaking. I tend to get a bit of social anxiety and get a bit frozen and sort of, I don't know. It's hard to think in that context. But above all, I've really appreciated and enjoyed just having comrades around, and you're very lucky to have each other and the opportunity even just to meet in pubs to just, you know, just discuss your experiences and, you know, working together is obviously a key and can help you overcome some of your alienation, just working together. So it's very, very special that you have each other. And of course, it was a great privilege to you know, be part of your group today, and really meant a great deal to me just to hear other comrades. And of course, it brought me back to when I was in my, you know, a younger man living in the UK and all that. But I really, really enjoyed it all, and I loved all your contributions. So I just want to thank you so much for that, and keep up the great work.
Thanks very much, Danny. Thanks for your talk and the interesting discussion. Just before we go, Howard, do you want to just kind of introduce what you'll be talking about next week?
Well, I think the title that's down in the standard on the website is Art and Entertainment in Capitalism and Socialism. I think probably a more sort of title that more reflects the kind of thing I'm going to say is Art and Entertainment in Human Society. I think it sort of, is wider than just in capitalism and socialism. I'll obviously be talking about capitalism and socialism as well. But so Art and Entertainment in Human Society, what it means, or what it should mean anyway. You've taken me by surprise, so I'm not finding much coherent to say, but hopefully people will find it of some interest.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that next week. And
by the way, another of the books, that kind of books that Danny's been talking about, was Yes Utopia by Ron Cook.
Okay, and that reminds me, if anybody's interested in the studies that have been done that Danny mentioned, loads of studies into how green spaces improve health, and if you were to read this book, it's called Good Nature. Good Nature by Kathy Willis. She's a professor. She's a London botany professor. She wrote this book, Good Nature, last year. It really will persuade you that you need to go forest bathing right now. It's really excellent. So anyway, there's my book recommendation for the evening. So thanks again to Danny, and thanks everybody for coming, and we'll look forward to Howard's talk next week. All right, then. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Good night, all.
Bye.
Thanks very much. Yep. Cheerio.